And welcome to the 29th episode of the show for April 17th, 2007. We're going to just jump right in with a great top six list about heist movies, which I'm excited about because I love a good heist movie. We have a trivia question, of course. We're going to talk all about widescreen films and how they came to be. Remember last week we talked a bit about this? Well, we're going to continue this with an industry trend look. Sam's going to bring back fact or fiction with some movie quotes. So we're going to throw out some quotes and see if you can get whether or not those quotes actually come from the movies we're going to say they come from, or whether or not they're just completely wrong. And finally, I'm going to give you how to solve a crime, just in case you ever have to. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard. I think we have a problem. I'd love to start out with the top six heist movies, but I can't find it. I think somebody stole it.
Ooh, someone stole those audio files?
Yeah. Well, all right. Give us till the projector runs out, and maybe I'll have found it by then. One of my favorite genres of movies, subgenres really, is the heist movie, capers, the kind of movie where a bunch of people get together, or maybe just one person if he's really good, and pool their skills and pull off the big heist, get into some top secret area and steal the whatever it is. So let's plunge right into our top six list, the top six heist movies. And my number six is a fairly unknown movie in this genre called Gambit from 1966. It's a fun one that for some reason is really just always stuck in my head. You know how some movies just don't leave the head. I'm not sure why this one doesn't, but it sticks in there as being particularly entertaining. And as it starts out, Michael Caine is sitting at a table in a nightclub, and he's got the perfect plan. And we start to see it unfold, and everything is going smoothly, but something doesn't seem quite right. Things are actually going a little too smoothly, and who is this Shirley MacLaine character is not even saying anything. It's weird. Bit of a mystery gradually turns into this great comic caper, and it's a great illustration, too, of the ridiculous number of unforeseen things that can make a plan go wrong. And that's really what the focus of this one is, and the thing that makes it a little different and special from other heist movies. It spends more time on the plan than most of them give you. Some don't give you the plan at all, you just see it underway. But this one is really intriguing for letting you in on that phase of it and then just showing you how it just can go completely wrong.
Yeah, my favorite part of the heist movie subgenre is the plan. Though my number six movie doesn't really have it. It's kind of an interesting heist movie in that we're not actually rooting for the criminals. Usually we are. And in fact, we learn that it's a heist kind of later into the movie. And that is Die Hard from 1988 by director John McTiernan. We've talked a lot about it in the past, and I think most everyone's already seen it. But I think it's a cool, fun heist movie because I like the way that there's sort of a heist that's a little peripheral to the main storyline where we're following the guy who's trying to foil the heist, only at first he doesn't even realize that it's a heist, and it's cool the way that it all unfolds and works out. Not as much detail or time is spent on the actual robbery as are in most heist movies, but I think it can sneak in at number six here.
Yeah, what a neat choice. If you do want to hear us talk more about Die Hard, that's back in episode 12. If you missed that one, go back and check it out. Well, anyway, my number five choice is a classic, The Asphalt Jungle. The Asphalt Jungle, of course, meaning a big city, and it's directed in 1950 by John Huston, a very great director we've talked about quite a bit. I love the quote in it, "Experience has taught me never to trust a policeman. Just when you think one's all right, he turns legit." And that kind of sums up the wry sense of humor that pervades this otherwise very straight documentary-like approach to a particular heist. It's exciting. It's very insightful, actually, too. The characters that pull it off aren't this gang of evil scheming masterminds or a bunch of wisecracking heroes or whatever. Each person that plays a part in this heist has a particular sharply defined character. It's quite realistic and his own agenda. And they're in on this as a business transaction. You know, it's not a team of buddies. It's just people who happen to make their living pulling off crime jobs. And so they treat this as their business partners, the people they're working with. But they all sort of come across like these consummate professionals, and evading the law is just this unfortunate hazard that comes with the job. Absolutely gorgeous cinematography, black and white, very haunting images, and sharp dialogue, too. Very clever and uses a lot of slang lingo in a very naturalistic kind of way. Of course, it's one of the great heist movies.
And one of the great heist movies that I've not seen. Well, my number five movie is a movie probably most people listening to this podcast have seen. It's kind of light and breezy, but it's just so much fun I had to include it. And it's Ocean's 11 from 2001 by director Steven Soderbergh. I mean, here's a movie that really builds on the heist movie cliches. It's clearly very aware of them and plays around with them and gets by mainly on its just incredibly fun dialogue and its great, great cast. I mean, George Clooney, Brad Pitt, Matt Damon, even Julia Roberts can't ruin the flick with her presence. You know, its sequel's nowhere near as good, but just a lot of fun. It's got a really cool heist, too, with some clever twists and turns, so they resort to the old, oh, you think I'm someplace that I'm not kind of trick, which I think I may have mentioned when I talked about pulling off a caper. But just a ton of fun.
Yeah, and it is one of the few remakes that is superior. We kind of forget it's a remake even, but it is a remake of the Rat Pack movie from the 60s, the Ocean's 11. But this one, very exciting, and talking about planning again, this one doesn't give you the plan at all. We see it unfold, you know, we're kind of duped by the plan as everyone else is, and that has its own neat kind of effect to it. Well, my number four, one we mentioned back in episode 3 in our top 6 list then, it's The Great Train Robbery from 1979. It's a period heist. And I don't want to add too much to what we already said about that on an earlier show, but really exciting and different enough with the different time period and the different sort of setting and older technology and everything that it feels pretty fresh.
Yeah, I was on my short list, but I was pretty sure you'd pick it, so I didn't have to. Well, my number four is a movie that, I mean, how could you not include it on the list? It's called Heist from 2001, also by director David Mamet. It's a really fun film with Gene Hackman as a master criminal who gets coaxed into pulling off one last job at the behest of Danny DeVito. And it's a little harsher than some of the other movies, but the plot is endlessly complicated with just twist after twist after twist. But the main attraction is, one, the central heist sequence, which is an homage to an earlier film that I think we'll probably be talking about a little later, but it's a silent heist sequence where they rob an airplane, and it's really well done. And Mamet's other big attraction is, of course, his dialogue, which sparkles all the way throughout. When this movie came out, there's a little minor controversy about one of the lines they used in the trailer that some people just didn't get, where the Danny DeVito character says, "Everyone needs money. That's why they call it money." And if you don't get why that is just hilarious, maybe this movie's not for you, but it's wonderful. And one of the great things Mamet does is a real meticulous detail to the way people do things, the way they prepare, and here we definitely get it. Mamet is really most known for perhaps his con artist movies, so there's a little bit of overlap between those sub-genres, and in both of them he's always very observant, and certainly here as well.
The secret to that line, I think, and of course, Mamet's dialogue is brilliant. It is a great line, but the delivery is fantastic. It's just so straight-faced.
Yeah, much better than mine.
Danny DeVito gives it. And Gene Hackman, too, is wonderful in that movie. Just very straight-faced humor. And, you know, when you say a line that's absolutely ridiculous, but you say it with complete conviction, that's just funny. You know, it feels good to laugh at, too. It's a lot different than laughing at somebody saying, "Hey, watch me fall over," and then he falls over, and then you just...
He falls over.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. All right, my number three is Dog Day Afternoon, a great classic movie from 1975, directed by Sidney Lumet. And it's interesting structure to it. It starts out pretty visceral and kinetic, and it's all this action and noise and everybody running around and guns, just very, very active movie. And then it does something kind of unusual and slows down in the second half. Once this sort of standoff situation has stabilized, it slows down and starts really exploring the character side of things. And so we have all these people, these interesting people under the gun. This is just a big pressure cooker situation. And so they're under a lot of stress, and that's a great opportunity to explore characters. And so that's what this movie does.
Yeah, you're really going to have to embarrass me here by picking another classic movie that I haven't seen.
Oh, Steven.
So it didn't make my list, but it probably would if I've seen it. Well, my number three movie is a sort of classic movie that I have seen that's not nearly as famous, and it's Le Cercle Rouge from 1970. I didn't even try and pronounce it the French way there, by director Jean-Pierre Melville. Melville also made another classic heist movie that was in consideration for this list, but I don't want to pick two by him. That was Bob the Gambler, which sort of actually influenced the Ocean's 11 movies about some criminals going to rip off a casino. But here in the Red Circle, or Le Cercle Rouge in the anglicized pronunciation that I favor, we get a really, really cool, meticulous heist, and it's got this really neat French vibe to it. It was made in 1970, but Melville's one of those French directors who worked kind of during the New Wave, but wasn't really part of it. He made movies in the 50s and as well as up to the 70s. And his movies have this kind of detached feel to them, not at all the same emotions and crazy stylistic devices that other French filmmakers used at the time. It's very laid back and sardonic as it watches these thieves who really can't reform themselves and this cop who's chasing them. And the centerpiece of the movie is this really, really wonderful, incredibly impressive jewel heist. And then one of the most interesting things is that the movie is equally as concerned with the aftermath, and it kind of all goes toward an inexorable conclusion in a sort of French tragic way, but it's so methodical and so fascinating to watch, and it's also a really interesting character study. Unlike a lot of heist movies, this film is not that concerned with being completely superficial. It really wants us to get to know its characters, really feel about them when they meet the ends that they do meet, because, hey, these guys are sort of bad guys who are, you know, maybe not killers, but certainly not going to shy away from violence if they have to, and they are stealing from people and dealing with a dangerous element, bad things are going to happen. So it's not quite as much fun as the other movies on our list, but I think it's every bit as fascinating to watch.
Well, that sounds interesting. You got me back. I haven't seen that one, but certainly Melville is interesting to me, and at some point I'm just going to sit down and watch a whole bunch of them. Well, my number two, definitely a step on the lighter side from that, and it's probably my favorite comic heist movie, and it's The Italian Job. Not the new one, it's the 1969 version with Michael Caine again. It's the second Michael Caine pick for me on this top six list. It's hard to convey the sense of humor this has without really, you know, if I tried, I wouldn't do it justice, and, you know, it's all in the nuance and the color and the delivery of the lines and everything. There's a great scene where they're testing out some explosives. Most of the movie is the planning stages. They're testing out some explosives on a car, and it just completely goes up, and it's just destroyed, and, you know, Michael Caine turns and says, "You were supposed to blow the bloody doors off," and just the way that the moment is staged. And then at the end, of course, a very famous climactic sequence is a chase and a bunch of minis. There's these three minis that just absolutely go everywhere. They do everything you possibly can with a mini and have a lot of fun with that. And the remake, you know, if I forget the original movie, I kind of like the remake. It's all right. It's a generic movie, though, and it's called The Italian Job, and it's set in Los Angeles. I mean, what kind of stupid decision is that? Every movie is set in Los Angeles. There's nothing to look at. That's very interesting. But the original, it is in Italy, so there's a lot of interesting scenery to look at. It's a different kind of a vibe to the surroundings, and it's just so much fun to watch them pull off all these different types of things to set up the plan. And, you know, the heist doesn't really take up much of the movie. Most of it is just trying out these different techniques that they'll ultimately put together and use in the final job. So The Italian Job, my number two pick, and lots of fun.
So you're telling me that you don't think, like, minis cruising down the narrow streets in Los Angeles is quite... Wait, there are no narrow streets in Los... Never mind. Anyway, number two for me is a movie that I didn't quite first think about as a heist movie, but the more I thought of it, you know, I realized it kind of is, and that's Heat from 1995 by Michael Mann. There are actually two great heist sequences in this movie. First, an armored car robbery, and the climax, so not quite the end of the film, a bank robbery that goes horribly awry and becomes very, very violent. The first part of it, the armored car heist, is fascinating. It's pretty much how the movie opens. We don't know the plan going in. We watch it sort of happen just as the movie started. We don't know any of the characters, and we're just impressed by how visceral and brutal this is. I mean, these are guys ripping off an armored car who are willing to use violence to steal the money if they have to. A lot of heist movies, I think, are maybe a little detached from that kind of thing. They have to be cooler and more elegant. Here, it feels a little more raw and gritty. But more or less, it goes according to plan, but it sets into motion the events of the rest of the film, which are going to be about a cop played by Al Pacino tracking Master Thief played by Robert De Niro, and it's going to ultimately lead to this just terribly gone awry bank robbery that results in this really, really, really well done action sequence where their criminals are shooting at the cops and trying to get away, and it just doesn't go right. The bulk of the movie is actually sort of concerned with the relationship between the Pacino and the De Niro characters, even though neither one really knows the other one. They only really have two moments together on screen. It's sort of about how their lives are paralleling as they're so important to one another. But definitely both heist sequences are really, really wonderful, well done.
Yeah, I didn't think about that as a heist movie at all. I should have. It's certainly a great great movie. There's one interesting thing about it, and that is it does tell us, well, there's two interesting things. It does tell a story from both sides. You don't just get the side of the people trying to pull off the heist, you get the other side as well, the people trying to catch the bad guys. The other thing it does is it spends an inordinate amount of time investigating the personal lives of the people on both sides of the law, and that's not something you usually get in this genre either, but you know, maybe that's why I didn't think of this as a heist movie. It doesn't feel like it belongs to that genre, but technically I suppose it does. Well, that brings me to my number one choice, which is not Steven's number one choice, because I think I know what it is, and I banked on him saying it so I wouldn't have to, as that gave me more room to talk about my own things. So we tend to do that on the show. Anyway, my number one is The Killing, from 1956 by Stanley Kubrick. It was his first great movie. It's only his third movie in total. And it doesn't feel a lot like his later movies. It feels a lot less personal, but it is so well done, so well shot, and speaking of brutality, it is more brutal than the normal caper movie. These are bad guys you do not want to mess with. They are ruthless, and yet, you know, on some level, they're also sympathetic. It kind of depends on what scene you're talking about, but it's very well shot, a very dramatic narration, documentary-like structure to it, played with time. You got a mixed-up timeline that was unusual for that period in cinema history, and sharp, sharp as a razor, tightly drawn. There's no excess fat on this movie. It just is lean and mean, gets right to the point.
Yeah, I knew you were going to pick that so that I didn't have to, also I haven't seen it. Well, yeah, you're right. You didn't pick my number one. I was sure it would make it your list somewhere, even if you knew I was going to pick it, because how can you leave off Rififi from 1955?
I know, it was hard to justify.
By Jules Dassin. Interestingly, an American filmmaker with a French name who went to France after he got blacklisted had made one of the definitive French films of the 1950s. One of the, along with The Asphalt Jungle, this is really one of the movies that invented the entire heist movie subgenre. I mean, we have all the elements here, and it's amazing because the heist itself is something like 35 or 40 minutes long, and it's all completely silent. There's no dialogue or music. All we get are sound effects because these guys are breaking into a jewelry store at night, and they don't alert anyone. They can't trip any alarms. They have to do the sort of thing where they recruit all these different people from various skills so they can get their team entirely together. And boy, it's absolutely amazing how tense you get without any sound. I mean, you get the sound effects, but you get breathing and footsteps and things being opened and closed, and they all have to try and be whisper quiet. I mean, wow, I don't know if there is a more tense robbery in all of film. It's just amazing, just incredibly influential. All sort of all the other heist movies since this have owed it a debt or two, and a wonderful, wonderful movie that I still can't believe it didn't make your list, Sam.
Yeah, I was looking at this as saying, all right, there's so many. My short list was like 10 or 12 movies anyway, so I was thinking, well, collectively we'll get it right. But, of course, if I had done this on my own, Rififi would have been number one or two, because it is an absolutely fascinating heist sequence. I mean, it's one of the greatest ever put to film. So, you know, I can just say that I was looking at this as a collaboration.
Gotcha.
Oh, another thing about that, Jules Dassin, that was his greatest film, of course, but he returned to the heist genre a little bit later with Tope Cappy, and that's worth mentioning just as a side note, because that also made my short list. Well, let's recap. My number six is Gambit from 1966 with Michael Caine. Number five is The Asphalt Jungle from 1950, directed by John Huston. Number four, The Great Train Robbery from 1979, called the first great train robbery in Britain. And number three, Dog Day Afternoon from 75. Number two, The Italian Job, the original version from 1969. And number one, The Killing from 1956 by Stanley Kubrick, with an honorable mention, shall we say, to the short film The Wrong Trousers, with Wallace and Gromit.
What? You just threw in an honorable mention there at the end? Did you think I would not notice that, you cheater?
I was hoping.
Ah, I'm too clever. All right, number six for me, Die Hard from 1988 by John McTiernan. Number five, Steven Soderbergh's 2001 film Ocean's 11. Number four, The Aptly Named Heist by David Mamet from 2001. Number three, Le Cercle Rouge from 1970 by Jean-Pierre Melville. Number two, Heat, Michael Mann's 1995 film. And number one, Rififi, 1955 by director Jules Dassin. Okay, a rare trivia question from me today, but you know, I've been just loving Grindhouse, and I've been reading a lot about exploitation films, and I came across an interesting little factoid here. It's there's an exploitation roadshow picture in the 1940s that is actually considered the most successful of all exploitation movies. So successful, in fact, that according to the Library of Congress, its National Film Registry picked this. It's the third highest grossing film of the 1940s. Sam, do you have any idea what movie this is?
Oh, the third highest... No, I don't know what it is, but I'll come back with a guess later.
We talked last week in our Film Buffs Dictionary segment about the idea of anamorphic and aspect ratio and what those meant. So we're going to follow that up today with an industry trend look at the history of widescreen in movies. Now, one sort of caveat is I'm not going to get too technical in this segment. More interested in how widescreen affected the industry and why the switch occurred. Because honestly, you can get really, really super technical. There's so many different ways of achieving widescreen and all these little subtle variations. So if I miss your personal favorite crazy widescreen format, you can forgive me, but there's plenty of, as I really discovered, plenty of obsessive websites out there that will walk you through every technical detail you ever want to know about everything relating to film. Anyway, we'll have some of those links in the show notes on the website as well. But let's just go and get started with a basic review of what widescreen is. And you probably already know it's when the image is wider than it is tall. And it's worth reminding you that the very early movies were... I mean, they're technically a wide screen. It was what's called the 1.33 or 1.37 to 1 aspect ratio, the so-called Academy aspect ratio. That's the squarish picture that most standard televisions are. And it's not a true square. It is a rectangle. It's slightly wider than it is tall, but not by a whole lot. And just to remind you, the aspect ratio, if you missed last week, is just the ratio of the width of an image to its height. So 1.33 to 1 means that an image is 1 1/3 times as wide as it is tall. And there are a couple of basic ways to achieve this effect. Remember that 35mm film is pretty square. It's not quite, again, it's rectangular, but that's the real limitation. 35mm film is going to be used as the sort of standard film stock from the very early days of film, both for photography, still photography, as well as for the pictures, the moving pictures. So one of the things that you can do easily to get a wider image is just use a wider film gauge. And we're going to see this happen a lot, particularly 65, 70mm films. Some people have done experiments like 50, 55mm. Those will give you wider images if you use that. You can also do what's called matting it or masking it, which is to cut off the top and the bottom of the 35mm film, and that way you'll get a more of a rectangular image because you're just going to crop it. Essentially, the downside with that, like we mentioned last week, is that you're not using all the negative. You're just wasting space, so it doesn't look as good when you blow it up. Now, another way that people have tried to get widescreen using 35mm film is to use multiple pieces of film. If you record, you know, three different 35mm frames all at the same time and put them together, you know, you get an image that's three times as wide as it normally would be, and there's a host of problems associated with that. And there's also the anamorphic principle we talked about last week, where you take an image and squeeze it down using a special lens, and then you put it on a piece of film, and it looks really screwy. It looks really, everything looks squished together, but you use up the entire frame of film, and then when you project it using the anamorphic lens, it reverses it and shows you the widescreen image looking correct, and that's called anamorphic. And finally, there's a combination. You could use anamorphic widescreen on a 70mm piece of film if you wanted to, for instance, and that would give you a really wide image. And all of these various technologies are going to be used throughout history. Now, there are some really early widescreen processes. I mean, people obviously knew about this for a very long time, but it's kind of similar to, we talked about early sound and color technologies, that kind of thing, where they're kind of experimental and not really used a whole lot. For instance, one fun thing I stumbled upon was in the 1900 Paris Exposition had two examples of widescreen motion pictures. One was called Cine-O-Rama, which, now this is a screwy system. It was a 10-camera system. So they basically took 10 cameras and put them around in a circle to get a 360-degree image, because they're going to take all these pieces of film and combine them. So you put 10 cameras all arranged facing outward in a circle. You can combine that and get basically a 360-degree image. Now, they're going to project this actually into a big cylindrical room, so when you stood in the center of it, you see all 360 degrees of an image. I think Disneyland and perhaps Disney World, I know Disneyland at least used to have this kind of technology where you could go and watch a 360-degree panoramic image. At the Paris Exposition in 1900, this was on display, and the image they were showing was actually captured from below a hot air balloon. They rigged up this weird harness with 10 cameras facing outward and had it suspended below the basket of a hot air balloon. So you get a 360-degree view of a hot air balloon ride from beneath the balloon. And that must have been a really interesting thing to see. But obviously, it's going to be tough for this kind of thing to take off because it's so complicated to film. You need 10 cameras, and you need a screwy cylindrical room to project it in with a bunch of projectors. It's really tough to do. But also at the same time, the Lumiere brothers at the same exposition were demonstrating a 75mm film system, widescreen system. The Lumieres were two of the early pioneers of film, particularly French film. They were the two who probably showed the first commercial exhibition of projected films. So these guys were really important, influential, and they showed the 75mm film system, but it's just not really going to catch on. And there are all sorts of crazy systems out there that involved multiple cameras, multiple strips of film, taking 35mm film and running it through in different ways, all sorts of weird systems that are going to be around throughout the teens and the 20s, and they're really just not going to catch on. There is a pretty important year, though. In 1927, two real big inventions occurred. Well, one wasn't really an invention so much as the film Napoleon by the filmmaker Abel Gance, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, a really, really well-regarded film from 27. He actually originally intended that to be shown on three different screens all at the same time. He put three screens together via three mechanically linked projectors, and the original film of that was actually, most of it was sort of one image in the center, and then a different image on either side, and it wasn't like creating a panoramic image, it was just really using three different images, so that you could sometimes, I guess, the left and the right image are actually the same image, which just must have been a really strange way to view a movie, and there are some scenes in that movie, though, where he does create basically a panoramic view, where you use all three screens to display one really, really wide image, and obviously that gives you an aspect ratio of really, really wide. You take three 35mm things, put them together, that essentially gives you a 4-to-1 aspect ratio, and that's incredibly wide. If you think about it, modern widescreen film, like the widest that we usually film today is 2.35-to-1, so we're talking something significantly wider than that. And also in 1927, a French professor named Henri Chrétien patented a system called the anamorphic system. Essentially, he had a different trade name for it, but it was an anamorphic lens for motion picture cameras, and went to commercial production in 1928, and nobody bought it. A couple of French films were made using it, and nobody cared. Over in the States, a couple of studios were experimenting with widescreen film, and this is, of course, right about the time that sound has come about. So people are kind of rethinking the way that they have to use film anyway. We've talked about they have to start adding sound actually onto film strips, that kind of thing, using optical sound system if they're not recording it to a disc. So they're looking at changing the way film is going to be, so they play around with this. And especially Fox had a system called the Grandeur system that showed wide movies using different film gauges, and they kind of experimented with a bunch of different film gauges above 35mm. And, these movies did okay, but a couple other studios played around with the same kind of thing, but just didn't really catch on. It's more expensive, and as the Great Depression rolled around, it just didn't seem worth it to spend all this extra cash on these widescreen films. And so really, by the time the 1930s come around, the Depression really hits, they all kind of get abandoned. Now, something happens in World War II that's going to really reinvent widescreen, bring it back to the forefront, and that's this guy named Fred Waller has been playing around with widescreen film systems in the 1930s. And during World War II, the U.S. military comes to him, and they say, well, we're looking for a way to train our gunners for airplanes, the guys who sit and shoot down planes and stuff. So what he does is he comes up with this camera system where they can record, take these cameras up and show different planes flying around. And he's going to use, actually, I think, five different cameras and five synchronized projectors on a big screen that basically forms an entire hemisphere around you. And it's going to be this gigantic, crazy image. And these gunners are going to have, it's essentially an early video game. They have these mechanical fake guns that they use. And there's a way that they can know where the guns were fired and where they were aimed to see if they're they're correctly hitting their marks. You know, they're supposed to, they see these images of these planes flying around them. They have to pretend to shoot at them, and they can tell when they got it hit. And it's this, you know, gigantic, crazy, wide, all around you thing, and has this system in the 1940s, and decides, you know, once the war is over, I can probably make some money with this. And so he gets some investors, including Merriam C. Cooper, the guy behind King Kong, and they create a system called Cinerama. This is a really famous kind of system, and it premieres in 1952. And it uses three projectors that are each projecting a separate piece of film on a really, really huge curved screen. It's kind of similar, not as big of a screen as the one that he played with for the military, but a really large curved screen, very similar to the idea that Waller's system used in the military. And it has just a huge hit. They're going to show one image from these three, so there's actually a place where you can see the image get stitched together, kind of like those old movies where they wanted to have one person play two people, and they just, you know, kind of spliced them together, and you could see where it was split sometimes. Same kind of deal, but it's just gigantic hit in 52. And I mean, the problem with Cinerama, though, is it's going to be super expensive. You're going to have these specially built theaters with these specially built cameras and these special projectors, and people love it, but it's so expensive and so ridiculous that there's no way it's going to be able to be implemented everywhere. But the studios see how much money. I mean, these people are just flocking to, you know, originally there's just one Cinerama theater, and people are flocking to it because they just want to go see it. And the only movie that really existed for Cinerama, the first Cinerama movie, is like this weird kind of travelogue documentary kind of thing that's not even really a narrative feature film, and people still love it. And so the studios quickly say, hey, we gotta get on board. And part of the reason that the studios are so quick to join now in the 1950s is, like we mentioned before when we talked about the move to color, television comes around, and television is square, or, well, not quite square, you know, it's at 1.33:1 ratio, and Hollywood says, look, you know, this Cinerama thing, this is a huge spectacle. Well, we can do spectacle better than TV can. They can't compete with us here. So all the studios start rushing to try and figure out how to do wide images. And 20th Century Fox is one of the first to jump on board. And in late 1952, this is the same year that Cinerama debuts, they're going to go ahead and purchase CinemaScope. They end up calling it CinemaScope, and it's the anamorphic system that Chrétien invented back in 1927. They just go ahead and buy that system from him. And basically, this system that they purchased, the CinemaScope system, just does a 2:1 compression. So the aspect ratio is going to be 2.66:1. It's just double the 1.33:1. So it's twice as wide as most other movies are, and it's not that difficult to do. It doesn't require special film or anything. It just uses standard 35mm film, and they can go ahead and show it. It requires, at first, these kind of specially larger, wider, kind of curved screens, but it's much cheaper to implement, and Fox experiments with it, and they come out with the films The Robe and How to Marry a Millionaire are the first two CinemaScope films, released in 1953, and it's pretty successful. For actually a while here, these studios are going to film simultaneously their movies both in anamorphic and in standard 35mm, because that way, if a theater didn't have the anamorphic lenses required to unsqueeze the film, they could actually show the standard or 35mm non-wide version of the film. But there you go. And at the same time, another system is going to come about called Todd AO. That's for the brainchild of this guy named Mike Todd, who is one of the investors in Cinerama. But he says, look, the problem with Cinerama is obviously this three-projector, three-camera system is not going to work. And he famously said what he wanted was Cinerama out of one hole. He doesn't want to have three projectors. And what they're going to go with is the wider film gauge. They're going to use a 65mm negative for Todd AO, and the print that gets shown in theaters is going to be 70mm, and they're going to use the difference is going to be for magnetic soundtracks. And the ratio here is 2.2:1. So that's still significantly wider than the 1.33:1 we've seen earlier. It's not as wide as CinemaScope, but, you know, they had this extra room also for the better sound system, which is nice. And so the first Todd AO film is Oklahoma in 1955. It's the first big 70mm film of the 1950s.
You know what's weird about that, too, is they shot it in both CinemaScope, I guess, and Todd AO. And, I mean, I don't just mean they had two cameras on it. They did two different takes for each version.
Right.
So every scene of the movie was reshot. It's very strange.
Yeah, I mean, again, this is just how experimental all this stuff is at the time. They're just screwing around with it. The other big Todd AO early film is Around the World in 80 Days. You can think of other movies that use this process, like The Alamo or Cleopatra. And there's going to be a whole bunch of other sort of derivative 65mm negative, 70mm print systems, and they have all sorts of, you know, crazy names. And CinemaScope is going to be pretty quickly replaced with something called Panavision, which is very similar in design. It's just they corrected some technical flaws that existed with CinemaScope. And even Fox will eventually abandon CinemaScope for Panavision. And it gets confusing here because there's a bunch of different Panavision systems, some of which are anamorphic 35, some of which are 70mm. And we're not going to, like I said, we're not going to get too in-depth, but really throughout the 1950s and the early 1960s, there are going to be all sorts of giant spectacle movies that are going to be shown. There's this sort of weird phenomenon that it's hard to imagine today, what they called the roadshow pictures, which were these big spectacle movies, either shot in scope or even more likely in 70mm, because then they have the superior sound. And they're going to be, you know, maybe there's just one or two big movie theaters in your area that can show these because they've invested the money. But you get these movies like Oklahoma or whatever that are going to come around to your town. And it's a big deal to go see a 70mm film in all of its glory and all of its great sound system. Now, as all this is going on, Cinerama is still kind of struggling. It's doing well, but the problem is it's just so expensive. And they kind of move away from the documentary travelogue type stuff, which they had done through the 50s. And in the 1960s, trying to experiment with some more traditional narrative films, especially the two films, It's a Mad, 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 Mad World, and How the West Was Won, both in 1963. And eventually, Cinerama is going to sort of end up using a different process, a single-camera process, where they just go ahead and project basically a big 70mm image across the super huge Cinerama screen, and eventually really Cinerama is just going to pretty much just die out. It's going to be replaced with either anamorphic 35 or 70mm. Now, one interesting thing is you can use anamorphic 70mm to get really giant, really wide film if you really want to. Most notably, the 1959 version of Ben-Hur, the one that you're probably most familiar with, the Charlton Heston version, was an anamorphic 70mm process, and its aspect ratio is 2.76 to 1, and this makes it really just one of the widest movies ever really commercially released in the United States. Just gigantically large. But as the 60s kind of wear on, there are going to be some problems. One is that it's still expensive to do 70mm. It's always going to be expensive because it just requires more film. Film stock itself is quite expensive, and so the studios are going to want to move away from it. Going to tend to favor either anamorphic 35, or even really just a lot of times they're just going to go ahead and do, you know, the so-called flat format, flat 35, where they just take 35mm film and just mask off the top and the bottom of it. And they're going to settle on an aspect ratio of 1.85 to 1 for these flat 35 films. And the CinemaScope, well, it doesn't get replaced. It gets replaced by other processes, like we mentioned, but people still refer to them as scope pictures, these anamorphic pictures. They're going to end up settling at around 2.35 to 1. And those are the sort of the common standards that we have today. Just because the sort of event movies really tend to die out. We don't have these crazy theaters so much anymore. One interesting thing is that, of course, it was also sort of problematic working with these super wide screen systems. I mean, remember, the original CinemaScope was 2.66 to 1. That's really, really wide. George Stevens, very famously, the director, said that CinemaScope was better suited to shooting a python than shooting a person, because people aren't that wide. So I think that's going to be one of the things that really does also kind of crimp these, is that 70mm is really wide, it's nice, but it's not necessarily that practical for shooting things that aren't super wide. It's great for panoramas and really big budget movies, but if you just have a comedy that's about people mainly, and most of your shots are going to be people doing things, how wide do you have to be? And so these days, really, we're going to mainly see ourselves at two different widths for most films. Either, like I said, that flat 35 at 1.85 to 1, or the current anamorphic spec, which is 2.35 to 1.
It's time for another edition of Fact or Fiction, the segment where we...
I love Fact or Fiction, man.
Yeah. We dig down to the truths of myths and urban legends about Hollywood and the movies, and it's all on Steven's shoulders to see if he does it right. This time we're going to do something a little different, though, because we're going to talk about a bit about the human memory, because it's associative, it's not literal, and what this means is that we remember the meanings of things, the feelings of things, and not so much specific words we use to express them. One of the many things this means is that when we remember quotations, such as any of the many famous movie quotes, we remember the meaning and the feeling of the words, but maybe not what the actual words are. And so, as a consequence, sometimes the line everybody quotes in popular culture is not as it was originally quoted in whatever movie it came from. So for this week's Fact or Fiction segment, I'm going to be presenting to you a series of classic quotes from the movies as the public consciousness seems to remember them. And as a challenge for you folks listening in, see if you can guess if the public consciousness remembers them correctly. Well, we'll start with the big one, and that's one from the great film Casablanca. It goes, "Play it again, Sam." Now, Stephen, is this really how it goes in the movie, or is it just how people mistakenly remember it?
Close, but no cigar, in terms of their remembrance.
Definitely nobody says, "Play it again, Sam." Of course, they're talking in the movie about the song As Time Goes By, and I love that song. Interestingly, though, the line, "Play it again, Sam," does appear in the movies and dates back almost as far as Casablanca, 1942. It shows up in the Marx Brothers film A Night in Casablanca from 1946, and so that started the confusion, probably. But it was really solidified when Woody Allen wrote a play called Play It Again, Sam, adapted into this great film of the same name in 1972. And that was sort of a spoof of Casablanca, kind of. Mostly it was about a character who was a huge fan of that movie, and then it turns out his life enters the same sort of situations that he eventually resolves by recalling Casablanca. So Play It Again, Sam is certainly in the public consciousness, but it's not in Casablanca where people think it's from. Well, let's move on to number two. In the 1950 show business satire, All About Eve, Betty Davis possibly says, "Fasten your seatbelts, it's going to be a bumpy night." Stephen, what do you think? That sound right to you?
I believe that's correct.
That is correct, actually. So we'll just move right on to number three. James Cagney's last gangster film, and in my opinion his best, it was White Heat from 1949, and there's this recurring thing where Cagney's character assures his mother that one day he's going to get to the top of the world, and he's always saying this. Well, at the end, he climbs on top of an oil tank as the police are firing at him, and he says, "Top of the world, Ma!" Or does he? Stephen, is this really what he says, or just another classic misquote?
I haven't seen the movie, I don't know.
Oh, you're at a disadvantage. Well, take a guess.
Yes, it is correct.
Oh, you're wrong. You should have guessed the other way. The real quote is, "Made it, Ma, top of the world." So, swapped around where the Ma appears. That's important. You don't want a misplaced Ma.
Not at all.
They don't like it. They don't like it. Well, we talked about Dirty Harry recently. Let's see how well you remember the famous quote from that one. Does Harry Callahan ever actually say the line, "Do you feel lucky, punk?" Or is that just how people remember it?
I think he says it, doesn't he?
Well, that's another misquote, unfortunately. He says, "You've got to ask yourself one question. Do I feel lucky? Well, do ya, punk?" That's how it goes. But people remember it the other way. All right, on to number five. I'll give you two choices for this one from Cool Hand Luke. It's a movie with a lot of great dialogue, but here's a famous quote. One reading that people remember is, "What we've got here is failure to communicate." And here's the second reading. "What we've got here is a failure to communicate." So the one is a failure and one is just failure. What do you think about this one, Stephen?
I believe it's the former.
Okay, well, you're right. However, you'd also be right if you'd picked the other one, because the quote appears twice in the movie, used one way and one the other. It's kind of a trick question there. All right, well, number six, I'll play more fair with you. Here's one of the most famous quotes of all time. "Beam me up, Scotty." Did anybody in Star Trek ever say that? What do you think?
I'm going to guess, yeah, I don't know Star Trek. I thought those were about movies.
You're going to guess yes. You sure you want to guess yes?
Yes, I'm going to stay with you.
Are you sure? Sure. Come on.
No, man, I'm not.
Okay, well, you're wrong. I was trying to help you out there. It's interesting because there's so much Star Trek material out there. The show, the movies, the animated series, and on. Nobody in any episode of the Star Trek series or in the Star Trek movie, does anybody ever say, "Beam me up, Scotty"? A couple times they get close. "Beam us up, Scotty," in the animated series, which, you know, barely counts. "Beam them out of there, Scotty," in Generations. The closest quote is probably from Star Trek IV, where Captain Kirk says, "Scotty, beam me up." But the quote, "Beam me up, Scotty," was popularized not by the show, but by a bumper sticker, which reads, "Beam me up, Scotty, there's no intelligent life down here." But it's interesting because that's the third movie quote so far where people mess up on someone saying the name of whoever they're talking to. Beam me up, Scotty, top of the world, Ma, play it again, Sam, you know, like that. Here's another one. "Luke, I am your father." Steven, does anybody ever actually say that in any of the Star Wars movies?
Well, I feel like I should absolutely know this, but now I'm... Wow.
It's funny. I mean, it probably feels like, why don't I know any of this stuff? But the thing is, you know, people's minds don't work this way.
I'm trying to run the scene through in my head. Search your feeling. Yes.
Are you sure you want to say yes?
No.
Okay. Well, you're correct because that's another misquote. He says, "No, I am your father," and doesn't say Luke at all. So good job on that one. All right. Quotation number 8 perhaps comes from the Oliver Stone film Wall Street, which is about a ruthless stockbroker who buys up companies to cash in on their stock value and leaves them in shambles. And he has this famous speech in the middle of it where he's talking about the importance of greed in a thriving economy, and it's called the "Greed is Good" speech. Ostensibly, because that's the key quote in the middle of the speech, but Steven, does he ever actually say greed is good?
I think he gets close to it, right? He says, you know, it's greed, quite frankly, or something is good.
Yeah, that's not quite it, but you have exactly the right idea. He says it with an interjection in the middle of it. He says, "The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit." It's an interesting speech, but so correct. Moving on to number 9. In The Godfather, Marlon Brando has a line that many people remember and quote, which is, "I'll make him an offer he can't refuse." What do you think about this one? Does he ever actually say that?
I don't know. No, actually, I don't think that he does he? Because isn't it... The best recollection of the movie is in the wedding scene early on when they're talking about a thing that's already happened where, you know, he made him an offer he couldn't refuse, put a gun to his head, made him sign the contract. Does the Brando character actually ever say it? I don't think so. I'm going no.
Oh, but he does, unfortunately. Yeah, I remember the scene you're talking about, and Michael Corleone later says the same sort of thing about, you know, he made him an offer he couldn't refuse or something. Well, let's wrap this up with quote number 10, a fun one about the Frankenstein monster. "It's alive!" Now, Steven, is this actually how the quote goes? There's only 2 words, not a whole lot of room to mess it up, but maybe our collective memories let us down yet again? What do you think?
I'm going to take a stab in the dark and say no, it's wrong.
Okay, well, if you say it's wrong, what movie isn't it from?
Oh, I bet it's probably from... Is it not in Frankenstein, but in Bride of Frankenstein?
You're very, very close. It's not in Frankenstein, but it's in something much, much more recent.
Ooh, is it Young Frankenstein?
Young Frankenstein, right. So in Young Frankenstein, Gene Wilder says, "Alive! It's alive! It's alive!" Whereas in the original Frankenstein from 1931, the scene being parodied in Young Frankenstein, Colin Clive exclaims, "He's alive! Alive!" So, either way, isn't it wonderful to be alive? Keep listening to All Movie Talk, because we'll have more misquotes and more urban legends in future episodes. Because we're alive!
Sooner or later, everyone has to solve some kind of crime. Whether you're the one straight cop in a department that's completely crooked, or you're the hard-drinking PI, or just the guy who's wrongly accused and has to clear his own name, knowing how to solve a crime is absolutely vital. I don't know, every couple of years, it just comes up, you have to do it, and it's best to go ahead and do it as quickly and efficiently as possible. So I'm going to present a little how-to guide in terms of how to solve a crime. Now, I've broken it up into vaguely 3 stages. The first is going to be gathering evidence. The second is figuring out who actually done it, and the third is catching the perp. The first thing you have to do is, of course, to get evidence. And there are 2 general types of evidence you gather. The first is going to be direct physical forensic evidence. This is stuff that's actually probably left at the crime scene. Hair, fingerprints, spent bullet casings, taunting notes left by the criminal, DNA evidence, blood, that kind of thing. You know, maybe footprints, who knows.
When a crime happens, of course, the first thing that happens after killers got away or whatever is a bunch of cops show up and they kind of mill about. Fortunately, you're going to show up and quickly spot the one obvious clue that they've overlooked. So when you arrive on the crime scene, you walk on, you flash your badge, or you wave them off, say, you know, hey, I'm the PI, or I know the chief, or I'm involved, or here's my son, or whatever, and they'll let you in. It's no big deal, because there's just, you know, like a couple million people in a given crime scene anyway. They're all not really doing much, either. They're looking kind of busy, but they're not really working. So your eagle eyes are almost immediately going to land on the one piece of evidence that will probably blow the case wide open. I mean, really, you're hoping to get a note from the guy who did it, or some kind of calling card. Those are going to be the best. But some fingerprints in an unobvious location, or some skin left underneath the victim's fingernails, that kind of thing.
Bullet holes are good.
Oh, bullet holes are great. As are spent casings. Also good. For some reason, those seem to tell you a lot more than you would guess that a hunk of metal would, but boy.
There's another thing, too. Even if all the police have gone over the area and left, and you're solving a case that is cold, I mean, it could be 20 years old. Go back anyway, you'll find something.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the next part about finding physical evidence, which is to canvass the surrounding area. You know, now you'll definitely figure out what the cops missed, because they missed important stuff, I'm sure. Plus, you can maybe talk to people. You can find other stuff. Maybe the killer left his clothes in a trash can two blocks away. The cops, most of the time, are kind of lazy. They don't really go looking for that. So once you've got some evidence, you got to collect evidence from witnesses. So the first thing you have to do is to find them. Obviously, you canvass the scene and hope to find them. Maybe you find surveillance video footage. And if you happen to get some grainy videotape, always just take it down to the crime lab or perhaps your local computer geek, because they can blow it up like, I don't know, 1,000 times without any loss of clarity. In fact, they'll make it clearer when they blow it up. That's how computers work. It's really nice what they can do with surveillance footage these days. But if you don't find anything like that, maybe you can find witnesses. And so the first thing you're going to need, obviously, is a lot of money to bribe people. There's a little bit of etiquette when you're bribing somebody. You know, you go in, you ask the bartender who runs a local CD joint if he knows anything, and he'll say, no, I can't remember anything about that night. Then you whip out your bankroll and say, well, what about my buddy Ben Franklin? Does his memory work any better? And he's passed the guy 100, and yeah, then you'll start getting some answers. You get pointed in the right direction, at least.
George Washington, not so good at memory.
No.
Yeah.
Really, you want to be going at least Andrew Jackson and above.
Yeah.
So, anyway. Then once you've got an idea of who to find, and there are two types of people you get information from. One is the seedy underworld guys, and the other is the sort of normal citizens. So the seedy underworld guys, if you can't bribe them, you just kind of beat it out of them. And there's a way that this works. It's pretty simple. First, you threaten the guy. He insists that he knows nothing about what you're talking about. Then you either hit him a couple times, or you dangle him off the side of the ledge a little further and go, I will let you drop! And then he'll tell you what he needs to know. For some reason, that first time, you know, you got the gun pointed at his head. He always claims to not know anything until you pistol whip him a few times. Then he talks. This is because criminals are not very smart. I'm not really sure if they just think that you're as lazy and dumb as they are. But they'll always lie to you once. The second time, though, they're probably telling the truth. So after you start piss-whooping somebody and he still insists that he doesn't know, he's probably telling the truth. The other thing is the normal civilians who might know something. These guys are inevitably going to become targets. And there's something you need to realize, that if you've been working with some guy and then you get like a phone call to meet him somewhere and you go to knock on the door of that place and it just swings open, it's closed but not all the way, it's not actually latched shut, the dude's dead. This is just, I'm not sure why killers can't shut doors behind them after they've killed witnesses. They just don't. I guess it's some weird compulsion that they have. So be aware of that, you know. Maybe recommend to your witnesses that they get deadbolts and that they use them, or they not let people in, that kind of thing. But gather all the evidence that you can. One thing to note is that if it takes you a little while to solve the case, the longer it goes on, the more likely the criminal will commit more crimes, leaving you more evidence. I mean, this will get frustrating, especially once your partner or your witness gets murdered by the killer. But you just keep at it sooner or later, and you'll have a mountain of evidence, and that's the important thing. Other people are a little expendable. That's kind of the right attitude that you need to have. So once you feel that you've got enough evidence, it's time to go to the next step, which is figuring out who done it. So all you have to do now is use crazy, insane logic to figure out who the criminal or killer or whatever is. There are a couple good rules of thumb that you can follow once you get to this part. First of all, it's never going to be the guy that's obviously the killer. The slightly unhinged psychopath who had a motive is not the one who did it. You're going to look for somebody that you don't suspect, especially a friend of yours, an associate, maybe even the chief of police. You know, the guy who's trying to be the most helpful. You know, you got to think about motives. Again, crazy, insane logic, backwards. If he has a lot to gain from me solving the case, or he's trying to help me solve the case, then he's probably the one who did it. Also look for people who don't seem to have any real purpose. They're just kind of hanging around. Those people are also suspicious. If you had any old friends or acquaintances suddenly reappear in your life, you want to put a double good eye on them, because they're really, really likely to be the actual killer. And you also need to maybe use some of the evidence you have. You can't just go ahead and say, well, this guy doesn't seem like he did it, so it must be him. I mean, that would probably work, but I don't know if that's going to hold up in court. So what you're going to have to do is use some evidence. Now, remember, the criminals love leaving all sorts of strange clues. If you're lucky enough to be dealing with a serial killer, I mean, he's going to just deliberately leave you clues to his hideout. These clues, however, will never be that obvious. So if one of the notes says he's hiding among the stars, it doesn't mean that he's actually in outer space. He's probably just living in a subterranean cavern beneath the Hollywood Walk of Fame. So kind of look for those. Also look for the unintentional clues. Maybe you found one of those spent bullet casings in it, and it's like a weird casing from some antique gun, and then you're in the chief of police's house, and you notice he happens to have a whole collection of antique guns. Bingo. He left those bullet casings and used an antique gun because he secretly wanted to be caught. I think it's pretty much standard that all criminals really want to get caught deep down. I'm not really a psychologist, but yeah, I think that's more or less true.
I got a tip that works for me. If I could just get stuck right at the end of the case, I just can't break it that last little bit. There's something I like to do, is just do something irrelevant. You know, go out with your friends that are not involved in the story thus far, you know, or just go bowling or whatever. Anyway, find yourself in a place, a bar, great place. Find yourself in a place where people will talk to you that don't have anything to do with anything that you're involved in. And one of them will say something entirely random that, in a different context, solves the case for you.
Oh, absolutely.
You just go out and talk to people. A stranger will solve the case for you. It's a law of averages. Eventually, it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and the light will dawn, and you just run right out of there. And don't tell him anything. Just run out, and he'll be all perplexed and everything. But you got it.
Yeah, also be sure to look for your dreams. Oftentimes, dreams contain great information about who did it. Look for any kind of signs or portents. Just be on the watch for anything that you can just take stuff you already know and put it in a new context, because that's always how it's going to be solved. Now, once you've used all this to figure out who did it, all you have to do now is make the caller. And this is going to be pretty easy, really. It's going to involve a chase through dark alleys or a sewer or going to some creepy cabin in the woods. So you're going to want to bring an extra gun or two, because you're going to need to fire a lot of them. It's going to help you also if you have some unconventional way of killing or catching people. Just so you know, though, you're probably not going to actually get to arrest anybody. You're probably just going to have to execute the dude, you know, in some sort of standoff. This is usually how it goes when you're dealing with criminals. You mainly just shoot them before you get them back for a trial, which is handy because, again, if you took the shortcut I mentioned previously where you just sort of said, well, it must be him because he's not likely to have done it, then if you kill him, you don't have to try and go to trial. And if the suspect has a hostage, you want to be especially sure to bring an extra gun. I would say at least three. One in your shoulder holster, one in the ankle, and one taped to your back. Because what's going to happen is the criminal is going to have the gun to the hostage's head. He's going to say, you know, give up your gun, throw it down. So you throw out the one in your holster, and he says, and the other one. So you take the one out of your boot and you throw it down too. But now you got that one in the back, so that as soon as the criminal moves his gun to level it at you, you drop to your knee, pull the one taped to your back out, and just fire away until he's dead. And, you know, actually, now that I think of it, apprehending a criminal is pretty much like surviving an action movie. So I would just suggest that you refer back to our earlier how-to on that one so you can get some ideas of how to survive an action movie. Again, the bulletproof vest under regular clothes is great. And you want to, of course, have a trusty handgun, preferably a revolver, maybe a nice Magnum revolver. That's what I would recommend. So once you have all these, you got the dead criminal, just go ahead and call in your sergeant or the chief of police, whoever, have them clean it up, and you can go on to solving another crime at a future date.
Yeah, there's one thing, though, that the third part of that gets a little different if you happen to be an elderly lady. you know, maybe you're a mystery writer. Mystery writers are actually fantastic at solving cases in real life, much, much better than the police. But if you are too, you know, debilitated somehow to be able to handle these big chases and everything, there is another way you can go about it, and that is just to, well, I mean, obviously don't just call the cops and say, here's the evidence, and go arrest the guy. I mean...
Yeah, they won't believe you.
Yeah, no. What you have to do is just to get phone up everybody you know and invite them to your house. You know, when everybody's gathered, you say, okay, well, I know who did it, and I'm going to tell you.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, milk the moment for all it's worth. I mean, you did all this work. You might as well get some credit for it with a little showmanship. I mean, you know, and bring an inspector along. You can invite him to the house, but it's better if actually you just have him hide outside the window, because then the killer is more likely to expose himself with a confession, and then you won't have to worry about the evidence part of it. You know, you just say it's him, and he'll say, well, I would have gotten away with it, and then the police walked in and get him, so...
Yeah, you know what can be good, too, is don't invite everyone over. Just invite the killer over along with the hidden inspector and then confront him and say, I know you did it.
You can
and
do that, like, too. You can do
be
that
like,
too.
Yeah, you know, you're right, but no one's ever going to find out. And then, bam, the cops burst in and grab him. That works as well. Okay, well, we're almost done here, but we got to resolve that trivia question I asked earlier. And Sam, this exploitation picture from the 1940s, is considered the third highest grossing film from that decade. Any ideas?
I'm going to guess Pinocchio. A lot of child abuse in there. It's pretty sensationalistic. Is that right?
Yeah, I don't think Pinocchio actually quite counts as an exploitation flick.
No?
No, it's actually a film from 1944 called Mom and Dad, which kind of interesting. It was one of the first super successful exploitation movies, and it's this weird movie, I guess. I haven't seen it, but having read about it, it's basically an excuse to show a bunch of footage of, like, childbirth and other stuff about various things about sexuality. The general plot is that this girl gets pregnant, and then and she's not married because her mom didn't explain to her the facts of life. And so the movie kind of, like, just as I guess part of the attraction of the movie was they got promoted in towns before it would show up, and then they would have, like, two guys in white lab coats who were allegedly doctors in the lobby lecturing during intermission and passing out or selling pamphlets and all sorts of crazy stuff. But apparently it was a big deal in the 1940s.
Weird.
All over the country.
Huh.
Yeah, it does seem odd, but I guess the childbirth scene was the closest thing to pornography that was legally available in the U.S. at this point in time. That's it for episode 29, but be sure to check out the website, allmovietalk.com. In between episodes, we post regular entries to the website there, all about current movies and random things from the past, and cool reader questions to get you guys involved, and there's a fun little community there, so if you aren't part of it, go check it out, register for an account, and tell us what you think about each episode.
And also check out rinkworks.com. We have a bunch of entertainment features there. Next week we'll be back with another episode, and we'll talk about Looney Tunes and Charlie Chaplin and ghost movies is the top six subject for next week. The top six ghost movies. Think about your favorites so you can play along with us. Post to our website, too. Tell us what your favorites were and what we got wrong, or maybe even if we did get something right. Let us know that, too. Cut! Oh, I didn't mean stop rolling. I just meant cut this piece of tape here.